By the end of 1944, there were well over 1,000 such camps, with more than 500,000 workers. Their labour was used by companies including Krupp, Siemens, BMW, Agfa, Messerschmitt and Daimler-Benz. Daimler-Benz was the preeminent motor company of the Third Reich, manufacturing trucks, airplane motors, tanks, armoured vehicles. The company itself was a personal favourite of Hitler's, who generally rode in Mercedes automobiles. The Führer himself made a special visit to the motor show in Berlin, where the company had a huge display. The huge taxes which the government had formerly imposed on motorized vehicles were rescinded, and military orders began pouring in. By 1940, after 7 years of Nazi rule, the Daimler-Benz workforce had expanded by 500%, production by over 800%. But now, as the war intensified, men who'd formerly worked on the Daimler-Benz factory floor now found themselves in uniform. By 1942, a third of Mercedes-Benz workers were foreign slave labourers, POWs, and concentration camp inmates. A Daimler-Benz manager recalls his visit to an SS-run slave market in occupied Poland.
I sought out Jews according to their physical condition. I generally chose the younger men, for I thought they would be physically and mentally suited to our work on the machines. Inevitably, I separated workers from their families. Shattering scenes transpired. The Jews had their belongings with them. The SS men were equipped with wooden batons and struck the Jews.
German companies constructed their own camps for these Jewish workers. Overcrowded, with little or no heat and even less sanitation, the camps were rife with disease. Defenseless, the Jewish workers were subject to abuses by SS officials, company managers and German workers, including torture and murder.
Die de Blas in einem Rathbark.
But the Nazi propaganda machine still churned. Week after week, for more than a decade, the German people had seen and heard the achievements of the Nazi Reich and its leaders in their newsreels. And even after Allied troops had already landed on the beaches of Normandy, the introduction of colour newsreel film in German cinemas brought a gaudy, surreal spectacle to the screens of the nation. The reality of the Third Reich was far bleaker. The Wehrmacht had run out of young men for the killing fields. The Volkssturm, or People's Assault Force, was a ragtag group of young boys and old men. They were dispatched to fight the approaching Allied armies. Untrained and ill-equipped, these were now the only forces which Germany had at its disposal, and they were thrown into the battle. Many ordinary Germans could simply not believe that their Führer had failed them. For years, there'd been rumors of a secret weapon to turn the tide of the war. In fact, there was such a weapon, ready only weeks after the Allied landing. The V2 was a quantum leap beyond any of its predecessors. the world's first ballistic missile. The 13-ton rocket carried a warhead with 1 ton of explosives. It followed a curved trajectory, reaching a height of 50 miles before descending to strike its target. In September, a V-2 rocket traveling at 3,500 miles per hour struck Chiswick in West London. The V-2 was invulnerable to any kind of interception. Nothing in the Allied arsenal could stop the V-2 or slow it down. Over 1,000 of these rockets were aimed at London before the end of the war, causing 2,700 deaths and numerous other casualties. But even this extraordinary technical achievement, designed by von Braun and built by thousands of slave labourers, was not enough to save the Reich. Millions of men and women, slave labourers, prisoners of war and concentration camp inmates, toiled and died to satisfy German ambitions. Millions more soldiers died on the plains of Russia, on the beaches of Normandy, and thousands of civilians in the bombed-out cities of London, Berlin, Cologne, and elsewhere. The legacy of the Nazi war machine was 50 million dead, and an abiding conviction by both sides, the victors and the vanquished, that the price of war exceeded its rewards.